Jesse, cue it up. Everybody in their places. It's time to go.
Are we rolling? Yeah, we're rolling. Okay, let's get it done, everybody. Let's go. Hey, Reagan, how's my hair? Is it okay?
Poxy, they can't see you.
All right, come on. Go, students, people. Poxy, start on page 4. Get the lines right this time.
All right, I got it this time. I swear.
4, 3.
Come on. It's time for the Ghost of Hollywood.
Welcome to another episode of the Ghost of Hollywood. I'm Miss Reagan here with Poxy Leonard, and tonight it's all about winning time.
That's right, and more specifically, how the book Showtime, written by tonight's guest, Jeff Pearlman, would take an 8-year trip through the studio system as it would evolve into what is now well known as the Max series, Winning Time, which gives a dramatic retelling of the Showtime era's Los Angeles Lakers basketball team.
Prior to writing Showtime, Jeff has written several other sports books, including another book about the Lakers called Three Ring Circus, focusing on the Shaq-Kobe era, and is well known for a 6-year tenure at Sports Illustrated until his departure in 2002. After the release of the book Showtime in 2014, Jeff optioned the book to an intrigued producer named Jim Hecht, who would work to have the story adapted to the screen over the course of the next decade. And after success, we now have Winning Time.
That's right.
Starring Quincy Isaiah as Magic Johnson and John C. Reilly as Jerry Buss, Winning Time is in itself a real masterpiece, delivering the story through a variety of visual, or shall I say, film-based medium.
Some ways. You know, nothing is spare, Reagan. This show has, like, a phenomenal look to it, that's for sure. It's got the aesthetic cover very, very well. But what drives the edge is the story, right? And I'm not being pretentious here. I mean, I know the old cliche of the story being the prime focus of attention and all that. But trust me, Winning Time is just straight catchy, dude. That shit will draw you in all across the board. I mean, as an example, I'll say, if you could all see me out there, wall crawlers, I look like a fucking punk freak from Mars. Or maybe like a dollar store Star Trek character. I don't know. What do you think, Reagan?
Probably both.
All right. I'll take that one. I always want to be the latter, just to say. I'm being honest. Anyway, basketball isn't exactly a priority for me is what I'm getting at. And although I'm not naive to it, that's for sure. I was a star in middle school.
Were you?
No.
I wish you were a star in middle school.
If I could dream. In fact, whatever. But I was pretty excited that when season 2 came out.
Well, I actually agree with you on this one. You kept hyping it up, and I blew it off until the interview came up, but, you know, now I'm watching this thing front to back, and now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is a hero of mine.
Oh, he's always been a hero of mine too, Reagan.
You're not gonna get any taller,
and Mike. This is bullshit, Reagan. One day I will get taller.
Whatever.
I hang for the monkey bars.
Anyway, Winning Time piqued my interest in all the actual figures involved in this story.
Oh, yeah. And so you read all about the LA Lakers too, right?
I know you did.
Yeah, you know, shit. If you think Winning Time is wild, you ought to read Showtime. I mean, it really is a lot of ways, like the narrative in the book is driving the charisma into this story. And I'm serious about that.
It goes deep.
Yeah, and I'm naive, right? So I'm learning about all of this shit as if I just spawned into America yesterday.
But alas, you're an old freak Martian thing or whatever.
Well, that is true, sure. Yeah, but when I was reading like all these stories within this story, I found myself awake night after night on Wikipedia or watching Lakers games on YouTube till like, well, I was doing it probably a little. It's unhealthy. Maybe I've been, but if you got any questions, just let me know.
Hard life, right?
Yeah. I'm obsessed, Reagan. Where was I in 1979?
Wherever you were, we're just glad you weren't here yet.
I think I'm going to buy a sports team, though, Reagan. This has influenced me.
Oh, which one are you going to buy?
It's a secret, but I got some ideas, though.
Anyway, how long did it take you to read all of Showtime?
Like a week, which is sort of slow for me. You know, I got that Kim Peek shit going on, right? Big book, though, for like 450 plus pages, so I had to go hard in the paint. Wait, you don't like a dad joke there?
What did you just say?
Come on, look, come on, let's go with basketball. Hard in the paint. Anyway, enough out of us wall crawlers. I'm Poxy Leonard here with Miss Reagan, and when we return, Jeff Pearlman will join us to discuss his work on the book Showtime and how this would lead to the Max series, Winning Time.
Stay tuned, because you're listening to the Ghost of Hollywood.
Ghost of Hollywood. Sorry, we'll be right back.
Interested in television or movies?
Then check out The Ghost of Hollywood for the best in cinema-related podcast at theghostofhollywood.com or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome back to The Ghost of Hollywood. I'm Poxy Leonard here with Ms. Reagan, and tonight we're excited to welcome our guest, Jeff Pearlman, who is here to discuss his book Showtime and how that would transform into the Winning Time series focused on the 1980s Los Angeles Lakers basketball team. And with all of that said, Jeff, thank you for joining us on the show this evening. How are you?
I'm very tired. So, but that's okay because I'm here with enthusiasm. So I'm good.
All right. That's good. We appreciate it. Yeah. We all got to do this one in our pajamas. So, following your book, Sweetness, which was about Chicago Bears football legend Walter Payton, you would make the decision to focus your writing and research on the 1980s Los Angeles Lakers during what is now well known as the Showtime era of Lakers basketball. Being that so much culminates in this story from the rise of prolific American basketball stars, major business transactions, and anomalous scenarios that lead to sudden twists and turns throughout all of this, what led you to challenge yourself with such a big project?
Wow, that's a hell of a question. I didn't really think of it that way. If I thought of it that way, maybe I wouldn't do it because I'd be like, this is too much. The truth of the matter is I'm really nostalgic. I even mentioned Walter Payton. I was nostalgic for Walter Payton. I grew up, you know, watching Walter Payton and reading about Walter Payton and sort of thinking how cool Walter Payton was.
Yeah.
And in a way, the same thing applies to the Lakers. I grew up in New York. I was a New Jersey Nets fan as a kid in the 80s, but probably the coolest team in basketball was the Los Angeles Lakers. I remember just loving Southern California from 3,000 miles away. And when you'd see shots of the palm trees and the coastline and Magic Johnson and the Laker girls and Jack Nicholson and all that stuff, it was really intoxicating. So for me, I think I did the book because A, it hadn't been done. B, there were just a ton of amazing characters from Magic and Kareem and Riley to Jerry Buss and, you know, Larry Bird and James Worthy and all these different guys. And then it just brought me back to my youth. Like, it made me feel, I like feeling like I'm 12 years old again, sitting in front of a TV watching a game. And a lot of my books sort of, I try to capture that for myself.
So when you're researching and interviewing subjects at the center of your projects, is there ever a struggle to stay objective as you build rapport and dive deeper into the details and insights of the athletes you wrote about?
Wow, these are good questions. No, honestly, there's not. Number one, because I'm probably a little bit of an asshole. Like, I
why you say that?
No, it's okay. For me, like, when you put your journalism hat on, you put your journalism hat on, and that's it. I remember when I was a younger writer at Sports Illustrated, and I started covering baseball, and I'd grown up a big Mets fan as a kid. And once I started covering baseball, I just decided I'm not a Met fan anymore. Like, that's it. I'm not a Met fan anymore. And you'll hear media members now say, oh, you should just admit who you're rooting for. And I'm always like, why would I be rooting for someone? I'm writing about this subject, so I'm not going to root for someone anymore. I don't care if the Mets win or lose. They're just another team to me now. And when I go into projects like this, if someone's incredibly nice to me, I'm very appreciative. And maybe after we're done, I have a nice relationship with that person, you know, send them a holiday card or whatever. But, you know, if someone was doing coke off a stripper's, you know, belly in 1983, and that's really interesting material or has some reason to be written about, I'm not going to write about it because the person, you know, knew my kids' names. I just don't work that way. I think you have to be unbiased and you have to see all these people as equal characters. And you can have empathy for people, but they also have to understand that you're a biographer, and what you do is write true stories.
And you had a lot of hard conversations in this book. I mean, you spoke with Spencer Haywood. I know that was and then you developed a good relationship with the McKinney family as well. And I know that Jack had been a little older when you had spoke with him at that time, so it was probably difficult to be able to get some of the full story in the way that you're trying to develop it. But you're definitely getting the objective kind of on the ground perspective of how this worked, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, my main thing is you call everyone, and then if you call everyone, people are obviously going to say no. Magic said no, and Kareem said no, in fact, two big characters said no. But my whole thing is, like, you call everyone, and the backup center was in the exact same meetings Kareem was in. The backup point guard was sitting on the bench, involved with everything Magic Johnson was in, seeing it all from that perspective of 2 inches away. Spencer Haywood actually is one of my weirdest experiences writing a book, which is he lives in Las Vegas, and I went to interview him, and he was awesome. He was so nice. He was really cool. I went to his apartment, and we talked for a long time, and toward the end of the interview, I said, can I use your bathroom? And he said, sure, it's down the hall. And I went down the hallway, and all I did was pee. I swear to God, that's all I did was pee.
Yeah.
And I flushed the toilet, and the water starts rising and rising and rising at a shockingly fast rate. And I'm looking around for a plunger, and there's no plunger, and the water's rising, and it starts pouring out over the toilet heads. And beneath the, there's a gap in the door between the bathroom and his daughter's carpeted room, and the water starts flowing into the daughter's carpeted room.
Oh, shit.
And I'm freaking out, and all I did was pee, I swear. And I go to Spencer Haywood, and I'm like, because I open the back of the toilet, I'm trying to fix it. I'm good at fixing toilets, actually. I can't stop the thing from coming.
Yeah.
And I go to Spencer Haywood, and I'm like, Spencer, do you have a plunger? And he's like, yeah, here's one right over here. He was so cool and casual about it. And he gives me the plunger, and I run back in, and I'm literally sitting there plunging Spencer Haywood's toilet as the water is pouring all over the place. And then I go back out, and I say, Spencer, do you have paper towels? And he's like, sure, there's some over here. And I go, do you have maybe like a plastic bag? And he's like, yeah, sure, right over here. I mean, like, doesn't bat an eye, doesn't say, like, what happened? And I'm back in Spencer Haywood's bathroom, water everywhere, sopping it up with these paper towels and putting them in a plastic bag, and then bringing the plastic bag and the plunger out and asking Spencer Haywood if he has a garbage. And then he's just like, yeah, it's right over there. And then I just kept interviewing him. Like, none of that ever happened. My odyssey at sea never happened in Spencer Haywood's bathroom.
That's what makes that such a unique story, though. And I mean, in Winning Time, they really took a lot of, because you go into depth in the book about his backstory and a lot of the cocaine use that was going on in the NBA at the time. And he's really, you know, brutally honest about it in his book during the interviews. Do you feel like they depicted that pretty well in Winning Time? Because I know they did bring some depth to his story in the first season.
I thought they did.
Yeah.
Wood Harris played Spencer. Wood Harris is awesome. He's been in a million things. And, I know Spencer Haywood liked it. And yeah, I mean, it's cool because there are a million stories. Like, I like when you go in depth into stories that most people didn't know about, like the Jack McKinney story. Most people didn't know about Spencer Haywood. They heard of Spencer Haywood, most people, but I don't think many people remembered that he spent his last NBA season as a drug addicted bench player with the Lakers.
Yeah.
So I loved it. I thought it was really raw and really good.
What was the most challenging in giving a full profile to these people while re-engaging this story to shed more light on the significance of, as we just mentioned, more previously overlooked figures such as Jack McKinney?
Okay, now are you saying what's more challenging TV-wise or writing-wise?
Well, definitely writing-wise, yeah. Like as far as re-engaging the story writing, because you bring you bring a lot of depth. Like, I mean, even in the, like, in the book, we go into Jack McKinney's early childhood with, like, Babe Ruth. You know, there's there's a lot there. You know, like the Babe Ruth funeral. Sorry, that was the one thing that, like, really uniquely stuck out.
Oh, thanks. I forgot about that, actually. The biggest challenge, it's interesting. Basically, I've written two kinds of books in my career. One is team books. So I've done the 86 Mets. I did the 90s Cowboys. I did the Showtime. And I also did a book, Three Ring Circus, about the Shaq Kobe Lakers. And the challenge of doing team books, especially multiple season books, is making it so it's not repetitive. Like, I know every season is unique and blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, they play 82 basketball games and then they play the playoffs and they play Portland and Phoenix and Seattle and Utah. And if you're not careful, it is pretty easy to slip into, and then Magic passed to Kareem, who had a hook shot over Jack Sikma, and the Lakers took a 28-24 lead heading into the second quarter. But then Riley made a shit. Like, you don't want to get bogged down on that, because most people don't care, and it gets really repetitive.
Well, you said in previous interviews, I didn't mean to cut you off, you said that, like, you know, a lot of the heart of the book isn't what's going on during the game, it's what's surrounding it.
Has to be. Nobody cares what happened in the Laker Jazz game in 1982. Like, even the guys who played in the game wouldn't care anymore, and they certainly wouldn't remember it. So you have to have it, because it carries the book along, and it's a sports book, and people like reading about sports, but it can't carry the book. Like, it just can't. It can't be the backbone. I've read sports books where it's like a season with the 1984 Denver Nuggets. I'm just making this up, but and you know, it starts with June, and it will start with, like, the Nuggets began June of 1982 on a 5-game string, starting in Utah, where they faced the spicy Jazz. But it wasn't as easy as one would think. The Jazz were without, you know, forward Darryl Griffith and blah, 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 blah. And you're like, why do I care about this? Like, why does anyone read and care about a game against the Utah Jazz from 40 years ago? So you just have to be careful, because the seasons do get repetitive, and you need to find, you're like, I'm a big fan of finding the new characters every season. Like, the Lakers will always, there's always someone. There's always a shooting guard, or they draft someone, or there's some bust, or there's some interesting fifth round pick who balances cups on his head. Like, there's always something that you have to find in every season, things that you have to find in every season that makes it more than just a season.
Now, with, say, with the controversy in the earlier, you know, release of Winning Time, with, you know, around the portrayal of certain figures in the show, was there similar controversy around the book?
No, zero. Nobody. The only one who complained at all to me was Mark Landsberger, the backup center, and he said something on Facebook about how he thought I got, I don't know what it was, I don't remember, something wrong. But Landsberger actually reported really well. He was a goofy backup center. And one of my favorite things about him is I think it was a preseason game. The equipment manager warned them, I don't know, maybe they were playing the Clippers, and they took the bus, and he's warned them, don't get your uniforms dirty because we only have one uniform. We didn't bring backups. And Landsberger on cue is drinking a chocolate milkshake in his full uniform and spills it on his jersey. And they're like, Landsberger, what the hell? You know, so, but no, I didn't, nobody complained. I think if anything, I heard very positives about the book.
Now, so let's discuss the point at which Showtime becomes Winning Time. So, being that the book was released, you know, almost a decade ago now, and there was a slow, and of course, with all projects that come to screen, it takes a while for this kind of to manifest and develop. So, from what I've read, and I know you've also done some interviews with Jim, but this all starts with Jim Hecht, who had, prior to this, was only working on like Ice Age Meltdown or something, right? So, when did he get involved? Like, when did he read the book and he was like, hey, I want to go talk to Jeff Perlman and see if he'll take this, let me option this thing and take it to screen?
Well, he read it very early on, because the book came out in 2014, and Jim came to my house in 2014 telling me that he loved the book and he loves the Lakers and he thinks it could be something. So he saw it early on. I mean, these things move at a glacial speed. Like, you know, the show just came out last year and Jim first optioned it, you know, 9 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I've said this a million times, but I never thought it was going to happen. Never, 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 never did I think this would happen. I had no faith in Jim, not because of anything against Jim. I just had no faith in anybody. Like, you hear all this stuff. You hear a lot of stories about stuff being optioned, and it sounds really good to put on your Facebook page. Oh my God, blah, blah, blah. HBO is going to make a series out of my book. Like, and I used to fall for that stuff and I'd be like, wow, that's so exciting. But then you realize, like, a book getting optioned is just one step way, 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 way before anything actually happens. And the odds are nothing will happen. Like, for every 1,000 books that are optioned, there's one Winning Time, probably even greater odds than that. So I never got excited about it until it was very clear that it was happening. But Jim deserves all the credit. He had a vision for it that I didn't even see.
Well, you mentioned you optioned the book to him for free, and, you know, this is something that you traditionally advise against. So, if you had believed this was a more serious proposition at the time, how do you think you would have handled the situation differently?
I would have asked for dough. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm thinking. Yeah, no. I actually don't know what I was thinking. It's one of the weirdest things. You should never give away your work for free. Like, you work hard on it, and you don't want to just give away your work for free. But there's something about Jim, either his earnestness or his decency, or he came all the way to New York. He doesn't even live in New York. He came to New York on Easter Sunday. We're Jewish. He's Jewish. It wasn't like there was some, you know, we didn't have big plans, but he came to my family dinner in New Rochelle, New York on Easter Sunday, 2014. And he was just a really good guy. I've told this before, but it still always makes me laugh. He showed up with three things. He shows up at my door. He's coming to my family dinner. It's literally me, my wife, my sister-in-law, Leah, her kids, Jordan, Isaiah, my parents, and Jim Hecht.
Oh, your parents? Oh, all right. This story's going to get good. Go with it.
It's just crazy. And he shows up with three things. It's Easter Sunday, so not that much is open. And you don't want to show up barehanded to someone's house. So he shows up with three things, a very big tomato, a block of Baker's chocolate wrapped in saran wrap, and a bottle of imitation wine drink. Not even wine drink. And I didn't realize Jim was in recovery and is still is in recovery. So the imitation wine drink makes sense.
Yeah.
But like, he shows up with these three things and you're like, what the hell is this? And it was just endearing. He was really endearing. He's really optimistic and he's pretty chipper. And we all just really liked him. And he's become a really, really good friend. I talk to Jim pretty much every week. So there's something to be said, honest to God, there's something to be said for just being kind and being a nice guy and being someone others would want to be around. That's pretty powerful.
What did you end up doing with the baker's chocolate?
I gave it to my wife and she was like, what the hell is this? And we probably baked with it at some point. I mean, it's not like you're like, hey guys, Jim brought over a block of baker's chocolate. We'll put it out for dessert with the muffins. Like, what do you, you can't just eat it. Also, tomato. All right, we got a big tomato here. We might as well, I guess, cut it and put it out. We'll put some paprika on it. Like, what do we, it was really funny. I don't know. And it's funny, I will tell you this. So maybe a couple of years ago, Jim's wife had a party for him.
Yeah.
And I showed up with a gift and it was wrapped in a box and he didn't open his gifts at the party, but it was a block of baker's chocolate, a big tomato and a bottle of imitation wine drink. And he opened it at home and he posted on Instagram later, this really funny post about opening up this gift and what it was and all that. So, you know, it's kind of funny.
It's got its sentiment for sure. Every time I see a block of baker's chocolate for the rest of my life, I'm going to have this, you know, that winning time story, that showtime story. Let me tell you this.
Yeah, exactly.
So given the amount of depth that goes into the story, because, you know, you spend a lot of time bringing each one of these figures to prominence in the book. Now, do you feel that this was why, and was this in early conversations, even in just kind of hypothetical chit chat, do you feel it? This is why it was better suited for like a television series versus a standalone film? And do you think that some of the sections of this book, because I do, could work well as their own television series or standalone film?
I mean, you could certainly do, I mean, what do I know? But I would think you could do a really interesting movie about the rise and demise of Jack McKinney.
Yes.
Or, you know, Jerry Tarkanian and his agent getting stuffed in the trunk of a car and that changed everything that led up to that, you know. Or, I mean, I think the 1979-80 NBA season in and of itself is just a riveting season. If you take those coaches, the arrival of Magic Johnson, Jerry Buss coming on the scene, like all that stuff is really interesting. I think when Jim came along and then after that, you were really starting to see the rise of streaming services and lengthy TV dramas actually based on books. So I think a lot of people in his shoes were actually thinking more along the lines of it's easier getting a deal with an HBO or Netflix than it is trying to get a studio to create a film for you. It was like the era when it was starting to be cool to do TV.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And you would have big stars doing series and whatever. Kerry Washington cut her teeth on doing TV series, you know, like that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I don't know. I guess it could work either way.
Okay, I mean, Jim found everybody under the sun to be in this show. This is it's a hell of a cast.
Yeah, it wasn't just him. I mean, there were a lot of people. Obviously, Adam McKay and his influence is a huge thing. And Kevin Messick and the other writers, Rodney Barnes and Max Bornstein is a showrunner. But it is... I remember when the different people were being cast and I said to my wife, I said, okay, I actually called her. I said, an enormous actress has just been cast in the show. Like think enormous, enormous, enormous. And she goes, Meryl Streep. And I said, close. No. And she said, Sally Field. And I said, yes. And she was like, holy cow. And that was honestly, I think that's one of the big moments for me is when Sally Field is cast to be in a show. And then fast forward, I was on the set. I didn't go that often. I went a bunch of times, but I was on the set one day in the parking lot and I see this older woman walking her dog. And I just yelled out, I go, Sally Field. And she looks at me and she goes, yes. And I said, hey, my name's Jeff Perlman. I wrote the book that Winning Time is based on. And she said, oh, it is so nice to meet you. And then I sat there petting Sally Field's dog awkwardly for like 3 minutes. And it's kind of a highlight, you know, Sally Field on the set.
Yeah, starstruck. You were starstruck there. With
I wasn't starstruck. I actually was not starstruck. I was more like, I can't believe this is all happening to me. I can't. How did my life get to a point where I'm petting Sally Field's dog in a parking lot? Like what crazy turns did my life take that happened?
That is definitely pretty surreal. You know, you go back in time and hit yourself like 15 years before and you're like, yo, check this out. You're going to meet Sally Field in the parking lot one day.
I'm going to meet Forrest Gump's mom.
In previous interviews, you've mentioned not initially knowing who Adam McKay was when you read about his involvement with Winning Time. Now, once you were made aware, How did this change your perspective? And did you spend any time watching any of his other releases to decide if this was something that you feel he could do well?
Yeah, because when I found out it was Adam McKay, so Jim calls me and he says, Adam McKay wants to meet with us. And I was like, well, I don't know who is that. And then I, so it was like, oh, just another meeting, another BS Hollywood meeting that I don't care about, right? Like, because I've had books optioned in the past. And I hate, first of all, I hate meetings, period. Like any meetings. I don't like meetings. And I became a writer not to go to meetings. And I hate Hollywood meetings. I hate when people all tell you how much they love you and love your stuff. And that's basically what it is. Oh, Jeff, big fan of your work. Big fan of your work. Love so-and-so. Big fan. And you're like, I don't even know if this person read a book I wrote. Like, I know they're just flattering me, and I hate that stuff.
Yeah, you ever challenge him with that? You ever, like, ask him, like, weird trivial questions?
No. I just sit there and look at my watch and kind of wait for the day to go on. And I mean, all these guys have families to feed, and men and women have families to feed, but I'm not a fan of it. And so with Adam McKay, I was just like, all right. And then we met him and he was cool. And he said he liked my book and I believed him because he's a big basketball guy. And then when I did start reading about him, I was like, whoa, like I will say this guy, like he's done some stuff. And I'd seen a lot of his movies. I didn't have to go see him again. Like I'd seen a bunch of his movies and he's a creator of creators.
Yeah.
So definitely, I'm not saying I started thinking it would happen, but I was pretty impressed or pretty flattered or something that a guy of this level was, you know, considering creating something with my book.
So there's a depth of research and knowledge to your book, Showtime, that readers are very hard-pressed to find in many other genres. Now, given the sheer amount of man hours that went into your work on this project, and to then have it optioned into a television series, what were some of your initial concerns in the medium translation?
Oh, look at this. Reagan, you're bringing the heat. I would say, okay. So this is the thing. Like I'm as a sports writer and as a sports journalist specifically, like I hate sports movies and I hate sports TV, 98% of it. And I'm an awful person to watch it with. Because whenever I watch it, I feel like for the most part, I know the story pretty well. And then I'm like, well, that didn't happen. I'm like the worst. My wife will be like, shut up. And I'm like, but that didn't even happen. Shut up. I just want to watch a movie. I know, but that didn't happen. Like, I always use this as an example. Moneyball. Moneyball is a... Have you guys seen Moneyball?
Yeah, I understand Moneyball. It's talking with... I've got a math history, too, so definitely understand Moneyball and the whole statistical play out there. Go ahead.
Right. So Moneyball is factually a very engaging and enjoyable movie. Brad Pitt is great. Jonah Hill is great. It's really great. It has a baseball down. The authenticity is there, whole thing. But we'll watch Moneyball. And I was a baseball writer at Sports Illustrated, and I did a lot on the A's back then.
Yeah.
And we'll watch Moneyball. And my wife is enjoying the movie. And I'm like, this is crap. Like, this is crap. They don't even mention they had three Cy Young Award candidates in the starting rotation that year. Like, their third baseman, Eric Chavez, was a perennial all-time. Their all-star, their shortstop, Miguel Tejada, was a future MVP. Like, that team was pretty loaded. Like, this whole, like, Scott Hatterberg made the A's is garbage. And I would go on this riff, and my wife would just be like, can we stop? Seriously, can we stop? And I'm like, no, don't you understand? Blah, blah. So, like, I'm really bad. The movie 42, the Jackie Robinson movie, I can't stand that movie. It just drives me crazy how they Disney-fied a legitimately important and profound story.
Yeah.
The movie We Are Marshall about the Marshall plane crash. I mean, I can't watch it. Like, it makes me rip my hair out.
Man, go ahead.
No, what were you going to say?
No, I had a question. But go ahead. You were driving. Keep going.
I was driving. So I'm turning left now, though. So I guess my main thing is, like, I had to adjust emotionally, mentally, whatever you would want to say, to the idea that this isn't a documentary and that they're going to take, it's based on your book and it's based on the time period, but they are going to take dramatic flourishes. I mean, I always say there's a scene in episode one, season one, where Magic and Norm Nixon attend a white party where everyone's wearing white and they play one-on-one in basketball and Norm is wearing a mink coat and the whole thing. And it symbolizes something, but it didn't happen. And that kind of thing took me it took me time to adjust to that, to the idea that they're going to make stuff up and it's based on something, but it also has to entertain. And what happened is I had a really good conversation on a podcast I host with Tracy Letts, who's a really well-known playwright, and he plays Jack McKinney in the show. And I asked him if he was bothered at all by the criticisms, because Jerry West had criticized the show.
Yeah.
And I said, does this bother you? And he's like, not at all. Not at all. He's like, here's the truth of the matter, and people have to deal with it. Real life is boring. If we did a real life show on Jerry West, we'd follow him driving his car. He'd go to the bathroom. He'd come out of the bathroom. He'd eat a hoagie. He'd shake some hands. He'd take a walk. He'd drive home. He'd turn off the light. He'd go to sleep. And I think that's a fair point. So I have basically, long story short, I've had to adjust to the idea that this is a dramatic reinterpretation and not a documentary. So you basically have to take a 400-page book and condense it to 2 hours. Winning Time was probably a 500-page book. You're condensing that to a TV show. So there's stuff in that book that I really loved reporting. Like, they had a rookie center named Earl Jones, who was drafted in the first round out of the District of Columbia, who was just a total catastrophe.
Yeah.
He might be my favorite character in the book, but he's never going to sniff Winning Time. So they just have decisions to make and choices to make, and they have to take something very wide, a book, and make it very compact, a TV show.
Exactly. Now, at what point, if any, did you begin, or did you become directly involved with consulting for the series? I mean, you said you were on set quite a bit. So what can you tell us about the early stages of development for Winning Time?
I mean, I basically run the show.
All right.
I'm just kidding. I don't run the show.
Will tell us about this.
Not at all. I am not even remotely. Don't use that as a clip. I'll never work again. I would say in season one, I was kind of a glorified fact checker, which is cool. Like, Jeff, did this work? Jeff, does that work? Jeff, what were the uniforms made of? Jeff, do you have any idea of this? Jeff, do you have any idea of that? And it's cool because usually guys like me are just kicked to the curb. Like, usually they buy the rights to a book and that's it. Maybe they let the author come to set one day and eat at craft services or meet a star and take a photo. And then they invite him to premiere, but that's about it. And it's been kind of the opposite. They send me all the scripts to read. This year, heading into season two, they sent me all the casting reels asking what I thought about different characters, who was good, who was bad. There's a lot of verifying information. I talked to the executive producer, the great, great guy named Kevin Messick. I mean, multiple times per week. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? Does this work? How should we handle that? And part of it is probably just being nice to me. But part of it is he seems to really value my opinion and the perspective of having written a book. Also, not for nothing, season one, my wife played the executive assistant to the Chicago Bulls GM and had an actual audible laugh in the pilot episode. I played a reporter. You get to see my back.
Where are you at? Where are you at? In the pilot, you're in it?
I'm in the pilot during the coin flip, right before the coin flip. I am a reporter who walks into the commissioner's office. You only see my back, though. But then, I will say, episode five, I have three lines. I'm in a press conference, and he calls on me, and he actually says, Jeff. And I'm a reporter in the front row. So I was in the series this year, which is one of the weirdest experiences of my life.
You like getting into the acting game. This writing shit's over. You're acting now. It's on.
Wait, I'll tell you, I never want to be an actor. I remember...
it's really boring, isn't it?
Holy crap. I remember... Years ago, I did a story when I was writing. I did a freelance story for a magazine called TV Guide.
Yeah.
And I went to the filming of a TV show called Love Monkey, starring Tom Cavanaugh and Jason Priestley.
All right.
I was really excited. I was there for the day. I watched him shoot the same scene over and over again. And afterwards, I sat down with Jason Priestley, who you might remember from Beverly Hills 90210, Brandon Walsh. And I said to Jason Priestley, I said, I'm going to be honest, that seemed really boring. And he said to me, he goes, brother, you have no idea. and I filmed a scene this year. I was so excited to do it. Like, so excited to do it. And I had lines, and it's only three lines. And I rehearsed those lines a gazillion times. I even wrote them down in my hand for the scene, like to cheat a little if I needed to cheat, which is total amateur hour, but I did. And I show up early on set. It's a Warner lot. I get there. There's a trailer with my name on it. I go in the trailer. My wardrobe is there because I've been fitted. I put on my clothes, my 70s garb.
Damn.
I go to makeup. They give me a wig and they give me sideburns and they glue it onto my head. I send pictures to my wife back home. I'm like, oh my God. Craft services, which is free food. I go to craft services. I eat my oatmeal with berries. I have some omelets. I have a juice, coffee. I'm walking around. There's the Abbott Elementary set next to this set. So I'm walking around the school in Abbott Elementary, sending pictures to my friends. Guess what? Finally, it's time to shoot the scene. And I'm incredibly excited and nervous. And I get in this room, and in walks John C. Reilly and Adrian Brody and Jason Clark. I mean, stars in the show. And I say my line, and I get it right. And they say, all right, let's do that again. And I say my lines, and I get it right. And they say, let's do it again. And I say my lines, and I get it right. And then they say, we're going to shoot from this angle. And I say my lines, and I get it right. And then they say, we're going to shoot from that angle. And I say my lines, and I get them right. 104 times.
104 takes?
I said those lines. It wasn't because of me. They kept shooting. It's this wide angle press conference. They kept shooting it from different things. Okay. It's now 10 at night. I got there at 8:30 in the morning.
Oh, my God.
Now 10 at night, okay? And I'm like, I swear to God, I'm like, how much longer is this? This is so bad. And all the other extras are like, this is great, because they're getting paid, you know, and this is a day at work, and this is what they do, and this is not what I do. Okay, I finally leave. I get home, and I'm noticing some welts developing on my head.
Yeah.
I actually called another cast member, and I'm like, I'm having kind of a reaction to something. And she's like, you know, take Benadryl or something. I wake up the next morning, I go in the shower, and my head is enormous. It is just has broken out, and I'm growing a melon from my head.
Oh, shit.
And I go to urgent care, and it turns out I had an allergic reaction to the wig glue. So not only did I do my scene 104 times, but the next day I had to go to urgent care because of wig glue residue. The moral of the story is, don't become an actor.
That's a hell of a story, though. Wig glue. Now
Wait, Reagan, how old are you?
You can have it like all over your head.
Reagan, I have a question. Right. How old is Reagan?
Reagan is 13. Reagan's 14. I'm sorry.
That's a mystery. Reagan. You can't expose me like that.
25.
Reagan, you sound very mature and very smart, but I want to just give you some advice. Can I give you some advice?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Say no to wig glue. Just say no. Your kids, the kids at school are going to put pressure on you. They're going to say, try it. It's cool. And you're going to be like, no. And they're going to be like, just try a little wig glue. It's really good. Say no. Don't give in to the peer pressure of wig glue. It only ends up with you in urgent care.
Oh, it's noted.
No,
right, thank you.
Do you feel, though, all right, so say, being that this is the first time your work's actually been adapted to the screen, do you feel that this has opened up, you opened up your work to a broader audience? It was like sports fans or just people in general who hadn't had interest before?
I mean, I hope so. Hard to say. I don't, I think book sales have risen, and they definitely released a new version of the paperback with, you know, based on the HBO series Winning Time. It's definitely given me connections in sort of Hollywood. I mean, as dumb as it sounds, like, now I'm friendly with Adam McKay, and now I'm friendly with Kevin Messick and these different producers, Sally Richardson, who's a producer, directs a bunch of the episodes. Like, I have ties I never had before. So that's really cool. And hopefully it leads to future projects. So overall, it's been a win-win-win, 100% a win-win-win. And I don't know how many people, I mean, you know, the show was originally called Showtime, which is the name of my book.
Yeah.
That would have been really nice, because I'm not sure. My name passes on the screen really quick in the credits. I mean, I'm flattered it's there and thrilled it's there, but like, I don't think a million people are Googling, oh, let's see the book this is based on. Whoa, there's a book by this guy, Jeff Perlman. Let's buy the book, and let's buy his other books, and blah, blah. I don't know how often that happens, to be honest with you.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, you know, it's that as far as, I don't know, to me, Winning Time's unique enough that, like, you know, if you're able to draw your attention over to the book, there's so much more depth in the book, and it's still like, it's incredibly narrative and equally intriguing. So I definitely think that if you're able to get that sort of cross pattern, or maybe, do you think it, like, new projects will maybe go into option? You think will actually see the screen as a result of this where you're able to translate your work so easily, you know, onto screen where it works effectively now? That proof?
Man, that is just really above my pay grade. Like, I wish I knew the answer, and I wish I could say yes, but I remain the same neurotic New York Jewish. If you're from New York and you're Jewish, you're raised to be neurotic. Like, it actually comes in your DNA. It's biblical. I feel like I'm always like, oh, this isn't going to happen. This is bad. Like, it's my go-to, right? We were raised that way. We truly are, as a people, we're raised that way. It's so funny because I've had this conversation with millions of people. I would never even think, oh, this is going to open up so many doors that I'm now going to be this cottage industry of books turned into TV shows and movies. It's just it feels like such a fluke. You know, like, everything feels like a fluke. It feels like everything is happening and this is amazing, but I just got really lucky. And there are millions of books out there, many better than the ones I write, that are never optioned. It doesn't strike me that this is going to lead to a million other of my books being optioned. But if that even happened one more time, I'd be really pretty psyched.
If out of all your books, which one would you want, which one that is not Showtime, but which one would you want to get adapted into either another series or a movie? Is there any book in particular that you would pick to do that again?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I would have never said this, but I did write a follow. I wrote a book called Three Ring Circus about the Shaq Kobe Lakers. And I actually think people are so, people love the Lakers. Like, they just do. And I feel like people love this show. And Shaq and Kobe are so much more recent. And obviously, the passing of Kobe is so hit hard. But I do think a series about that era would be really fun. It'd be a really, really fun and interesting progression from the show, from Showtime, from Winning Time to whatever it would be called.
All right. So let's get into the historic rivalry between Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. Did you have any trepidation in attempting to then retell such a famous story? And what do you think about how this legend has been translated on screen?
No, I didn't have trepidation about it, but the challenge is that you want to, something that's been written about a million times, like Bird Magic, Magic Bird, the whole thing, you don't want to just say the same stuff everyone else has said. That's really the challenge. And in a lot of ways, that's the challenge of writing, period, is to come up with new material, new information, and find a new way to present it. So I didn't want to screw that up. I don't know if I did or didn't. I didn't want to screw it up. And I think the casting, specifically the casting of Magic and Bird in this show, is preposterously good.
Yes.
First of all, they're two unknowns, complete unknowns. Quincy Isaiah plays Magic. Sean Patrick Small plays Bird. I mean, Quincy, this is my line and I'm sticking with it. You could spend the next 100 years trying to cast Magic Johnson and you wouldn't find someone better than him.
Quincy Isaiah is Magic Johnson.
Yeah, it's uncanny. He really is. It's uncanny. And he's also like Magic, he's from Michigan. Like Magic, he was a college athlete. Quincy, however, played college football at Kalamazoo College. He had almost no acting experience, some local stuff, that's it. The guy who plays Bird, Sean Patrick Small, very little acting experience, really more of a writer than an actor. He got the gig after a comedian named Bo Burnham dropped out of the project, and the Sean Patrick Small stepped in. I also think, just because we're on the subject, the casting of Kareem, Dr. Solomon Hughes, is just preposterously good. Like that, those are three enormous characters who everybody knows what they look like. And to be able to cast that so well is just phenomenal. So I think the Bird Magic bringing it to the screen has been pretty impressive. There was a scene in episode 4 that I just love. And it's when Larry Bird plays his first time with Indiana State and he's wearing boots, jeans, and a flannel.
Yeah.
And I thought everything about that scene just nailed who Larry Bird is and what he represents. So I think it's really good.
You know, Larry Bird's so friendly, right? You know, and my introduction to him was a bit post his career, obviously. So it's amazing to look at it and see how heightened of a villain they almost make him. But in the second season, as it brings more depth, you're starting to see this. You're starting to understand Larry Bird a little more with the backstory of his family and how he's grown up and you know, coming from French Lick and just the anomaly that he really is. But, you know, it's even like, say, with Jason Segel's casting, like he has like a pretty good like background in basketball, his like basketball, doesn't he as well?
Yeah, he was a high school star out here in Southern California. Like really, really good player. A lot of these guys have sports backgrounds. It may not be basketball. Like Solomon Hughes was starting center at Cal. So he's definitely the most legit basketball player. Devon Nixon, who's Norm Nixon's son, is just a really good athlete. He also played Whitney Houston's son in The Bodyguard. He's been an actor forever. Oh, Austin Aaron, who plays Mark Landsberger, was a wide receiver at Cal. Sean, who plays Larry Bird, was a really good high school basketball player. So, you know, guys have varying degrees of athleticism. It's funny because some guys like Delonte D'Souza, who plays Michael Cooper, had probably never heard of Michael Cooper. I'm not sure he ever watched an NBA game. Like, he was not a basketball guy at all, but he pulls it off really well. They also employ a lot of stunt doubles, basketball doubles, you know, guys who played high-level European ball, Division I ball. So I actually, one of the things I was worried about with the show, or thought about, is I hate movies and TV shows where the sports is terrible. It's obvious that it sucks, and they went cheap on it, and they have the actors who can barely dribble doing it. And this show, I think the sports itself is really strong.
Yeah, how are you, like, have you been on, when you've been on set when they've been shooting it, what is it, what's it like shooting on the floor? I mean, there's a lot of movement with this, so, you know, it definitely brings the intensity to the gameplay.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a couple of things. One of the interesting things is the cameramen, a lot of times have shoot on rollerblades.
That's what I thought. I was going to say Steadicam on rollerblades, I guarantee.
On rollerblades, which is cool. And also, you know, it's like anything, like what you see is different than what you see in person when they're filming it. Like they shoot these individual scenes over and over and over again. So you see Kareem get a rebound, look up to throw the outlet, or they're shooting that 50 times. It's not like it's just a game going on and that was one moment in a game. Like they're not playing many games. They're shooting individual basketball scenes and then piecing them together.
Now that the show is well into its second season, what do you think has been most significant overall in the story's portrayal that has allowed the screenwriting team to align Winning Time with the Showtime book?
It's interesting because some of it really deviates from the book, and not in an untruthful way, but like I don't get into Jerry Buss nearly as much as the show does. Jeannie Buss is barely in my book.
Yeah.
And she's a major character here. But I think the development of Magic Johnson is a major component of my book, major, from growing up in Michigan to going to Michigan State and sort of finding his voice and finding his footing in LA. There's a scene in my book. It's the one thing that annoyed me. The one thing that really annoyed me was there's a scene in my book that I just think is so, it's the scene I think of when I think of the Lakers, when I think of this project, when I think of everything, and they didn't use it in the show. And it's Magic Johnson coming to California for his first time. He's a kid from Michigan.
Yeah.
And he's just blown away that they grow fruit on trees. And he has the car he's in stop. And he gets out of the car. It's a sunny day in California. And he plucks an orange from a tree. And he just holds the orange and looks at the orange. And I feel like, to me, that's Magic Johnson arriving in Hollywood. It's him being blown away by fruit on trees. They never used it. It's fine. I'm not mad or anything. I just like, I love that moment. And I think their development of Magic Johnson adheres very well to the book and what I was also thinking.
So Winning Time had an incredibly successful debut in March of 2022 with nearly 1 million viewers, while season 2 saw well over 500,000 on its debut. So you've recently addressed concerns that if viewership doesn't increase in the short term, the show faces the dangers of cancellation. So at this point in time, are you still concerned about the show's future?
Very. First of all, it's a writer strike and an actor strike going on right now. So like the writers of the show, I'm not a writer, so I can do this, but like the writers and the actors can't promote it. I've used this example a couple of times, but there's a Zendaya movie, a movie that she stars in that's supposed to come out later this year. And the studio pushed it back to next year, even though the movie's done, because Zendaya and her 100 million Instagram followers, like she can't post anything to them. And that's a major marketing tool nowadays, or stars and their social medias. So we have this show out by Adrian Brody, John C. Reilly, Rob Morgan, Quincy, Sally Field, name your star. Can't talk about it. Can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So, and HBO Max, you know, I wouldn't say their app is that functional right now. Not fully. God love them and they've been great to me, but I do get a lot of people complaining about it. It's really hard to navigate. So we're definitely sort of running into the wind a little bit. Viewership has definitely picked up a lot, but I definitely wouldn't say it's a guarantee to come back.
Now, with season 2 being more heavily focused on figures such as Larry Bird and Paul Westhead, you know, and bringing more depth to the significance of certain characters in the story later on. And I know this will probably eventually, if we're able to get there, will culminate in Pat O'Reilly and his rise in the coaching area. Now, when you were developing Showtime, what challenged you with writing these sections, particularly in the earlier parts of the book? I mean, say like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's backlog is almost bringing a stranger that, if you know them topically in the book, you begin to learn them in depth by learning Kareem Abdul's transition all the way through high school into becoming, you know, first to Milwaukee and then eventually out to Los Angeles. So how was it bringing all of that into fruition in the book for you when you were researching it? How much did you have to put into that?
It's really hard. I mean, I'm not saying this is like ditch digging or firefighting or anything like that. I'm not saying it's that hard, but a lot of times when you're working on a book, you'll call someone or you'll tell someone you're calling someone and they'll say, well, why are you calling that person? That person wasn't involved. And it's like a book is not a straight line. Like a book isn't, okay, magic arrives in 79 and magic leaves in 91. It's actually a zigzag winding left, right, up, down, twisting around line. And you start writing about Kareem and you really want to know his backstory and you want to understand his backstory because you want readers to understand his backstory. So all of a sudden, you're not even talking to people with the Lakers. You're talking to people who grew up with him in New York City. You're talking to people who played with him at UCLA or played with him with the Milwaukee Bucks. And it's the same with all the main characters. A book takes you on this winding path where you never quite know who you're going to talk to the next day. And names enter your head. I always use this as an example, but you could be writing about Byron Scott, the Lakers shooting guard. And someone, you might read some old article where it says, Byron Scott was looking for his home to buy a house in Inglewood. And luckily he found Margie Taylor, real estate agent. And I always be like, oh, I'm going to call Margie Taylor and see if she remembers selling a house to Byron Scott. Now, Margie Taylor wouldn't be expecting a call. And maybe a lot of people would say, why are you calling her? That's a waste of time. But maybe Margie Taylor remembers Byron Scott dropping an ice cream cone on the floor and forgetting to clean it up. And Margie says to me, it was so rude of him. He dropped his ice cream and just didn't clean it up. And that's an interesting detail.
Go ahead. You were speaking. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, so you just wind up doing all these different twists and turns and you don't even use half of it, you know, but you find yourself just riveted by little divots in time and where they take you.
All right. So going forward, what do you hope to see from the rest of the Showtime story developed in Winning Time? And how has this experience prepared you for the future potential of having additional books adapted for the screen?
Well, Reagan, here's what I can tell you.
All right.
I'm a middle-aged writer with two kids. One is a high school senior, one in college. And college costs a lot of money. And the longer this show goes on, the better I am to pay my kids' college tuition. So that's very helpful for me. So if you want to support a middle-aged Jewish writer with two kids about to be in college, watch Winning Time.
All right.
I'm just kidding. No, I'm just kidding.
This is good. Keep pitching.
I'm totally messing with you.
We were going to get the school name in next and be like, look, we need some sponsorships.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to start a GoFundMe.
Oh, God.
I just think the show is great. Like, I love this show, and I think it's awesome, and I want it to continue, and I want these actors to continue to work. And the idea of Quincy not playing Magic anymore kind of breaks my heart, and the same with Solomon and Sean and all these guys. Like, they're great at this, and this is – I used to say to the different guys, like, can you believe you're on set? Like, you're on a set of an HBO show. Like, you're Quincy Isaiah. You're 24 years old. You've never acted. You have no IMDb page. And suddenly you're on an HBO show starring alongside John C. Reilly. Like, what the heck? This is amazing. And I just greedily want that to continue. And I hope the story goes on till Magic's, you know, it's like Magic ends up getting HIV and having to retire.
Well, that's in the very, you know, Reagan brought a point to me. So I had watched... Reagan brought back the point with Magic Johnson in the very because you know you get so far into the story you almost forget. Do you think is there a point where the story comes full circle in this Joycean sense where you get back to in the very very beginning where Magic Johnson is sitting there, has been first diagnosed, guys cried in the car, and he's looking at Michael Jordan on the magazines where you know I guess Michael's kind of up and coming's the implication. Is the story going to get back to that?
It really depends on viewership and if people keep watching the show.
Yeah.
Just being honest with you. Like, it could, but that would be taking it all the way back to 1991 and we're only up to 1984. So that would be wonderful, but I just don't know. Like, I just, honest to God, I just don't know. I don't know how this business works. At the end of the day, I'm a sports writer who's gotten really fortunate and has gotten to dip his toe in this area. I just don't know. I hope so.
When looking at the painstaking details included in a period piece, right? So like all of the cinema, everything that goes into making Winning Time, do you think that the production of Winning Time with the likeness portrayed lends to the show's ability to authentically convey the essence of the Showtime era on the screen?
Oh, 100%. 100%. The look is so much. In a way, the look is its own character. I mean, the show costs a lot of money. Like, it costs a lot of money. It's a very expensive show to shoot. And part of the reason is because the authenticity is off the charts. It's funny. I watched episode 4 and they were playing like the Indiana Pacers and they played the Pacers. You probably saw the Pacers players a grand total of 90 seconds at most.
Yeah.
And they had them on not just in accurate Pacer uniforms, But they clearly went over the roster to make sure who was on the team at that day, and then had actors who at least somewhat resembled them stature-wise. And they did the same when they played like the Jazz, and when they play the Nuggets, and they play the Sixers. Like, the realness of it is the star of the show in a lot of ways, that you feel like you're back in time, you feel like you're watching 1982 NBA basketball. I mean, that's everything. It's everything, because you really, the thing is, in a lot of ways, you don't notice it when it's there, but you really notice it when it's not there, when you're watching a movie and it feels artificial, or they're supposed to be shooting in New York, but you know it's Toronto. You can tell they're in Toronto, they're not in New York. Like, those things bounce off. And I feel like this show's authenticity is really the star of stars.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you met the editor, that it has to edit this show has to take a long fucking time.
That's amazing. It's just amazing. Everything that goes into a show, it's blown my mind. The level of detail, the level of effort, the level of care, the obsessiveness. I remember early on when this was going on, and someone called me to find out if I knew what the fabric was that they used to make the 1979 Adidas Summer League uniforms, because they have one scene and they want to get the uniforms right. I mean, that's insanity, but beautiful insanity.
Attention to detail. Well, all right, Jeff Perlman, we're going to let you go. What are you working on now? You got anything you can leak on us? I know you obviously spend a lot of time doing investigative journalism and research to put these things together. Is there something on the horizon for the future of your writing career? New book you're going to put on the shelf anytime soon?
I'm working on a book about Reagan's favorite musician. Reagan, who's your favorite musician?
I honestly have no idea. I really like the Japanese city pop kind of genre.
Reagan, you're supposed to say Tupac.
You're supposed to say Tupac.
Yeah, come on, get it
together. Reagan, take two. Reagan, who's your favorite musician, would you say? If you had to say one person.
Tupac.
Holy cow, Reagan. I'm writing a biography of Tupac. That is crazy.
Oh, wow.
Reagan, can I interview you for the book?
I mean, of course.
Wow, Reagan, what's your favorite Tupac song, Reagan?
Say Changes, it's a classic.
Reagan?
Changes, it's a classic.
I feel like maybe
you young
Reagan.
People today. Are you going to talk about that scene in Nothing But Trouble when they get arrested in Vulcanville and Digital Underground, where they're singing, you know, and he's a backup singer?
Of course.
That's the best Easter egg in that movie. You always got to be like, yo, there's Tupac behind Shock G.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very funny. Of course. That's a horrible movie.
it definitely didn't do Dan Aykroyd's directing career any favors. That's for sure.
No, it's not the best. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Of course.
All right. Well, Jeff Perlman, thank you for your time. Everyone out there listening, support Winning Time. Definitely want to keep this thing going to see if we can get the story to its fruition. And definitely want to check out Showtime if you haven't read it, because that's going to bring a lot of depth to the story and give you some narrative and background that you just wouldn't anticipate. And then, you know, I now also, as I've read Showtime, probably going to spend the next like 3 or 4 months just catching up on all of the Lakers games from the 80s that I missed before I was born. So
you're now the ultimate Lakers fan.
Yeah, I hear you. All right. Well, Jeff, thank you for your time. We appreciate you joining us here on The Ghost of Hollywood tonight.
I mean, it's my pleasure. And I just want you to know, Reagan is the star of the show.
I know. I mean, I'm aging out, so we got to hand it to
Reagan. There should be a solo show. I'm just saying, Reagan's kind of carrying you along a little bit. I feel like
I'm getting my screen time.
If you want to branch off and kind of ditch old dad, I think, you know, you can do that. That's cool. He won't mind.
Finally.
We're going to be like, all right, remember that show Reagan used to host?
Thank
you so much. That was awesome.
All right. I'm going down Robert Montgomery style. All right. Thanks so much for your time, Jeff. You take care.
All right. Take care. See y'all.
See ya.
Interested in television or movies?
Then check out The Ghost of Hollywood for the best in cinema-related podcast at theghostofhollywood.com or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome back to The Ghost of Hollywood. I'm Poxy Leonard here with Miss Reagan, and we've just finished speaking with author and journalist Jeff Perlman about his 2014 book, Showtime, being adapted into the well-known Max series, Winning Time.
We'd like to thank Jeff for being the first to acknowledge that Poxy is long obsolete and that I've finally come to prominence.
Whatever. At least I can name a Tupac song.
Yeah, at least you're finally good for something.
Yeah, I hear ya. All right. Well, Wallcrawlers, that wraps things up for the 29th episode right here on The Ghost of Hollywood. If you haven't checked out Jeff's book Showtime, which of course is focused on the Showtime era of the Lakers and their, you know, their whole game there. And then we got other books he's written. Of course, we mentioned the Walter Payton book Sweetness, and then there's the Three Ring Circus. And then there's books we didn't mention that Jeff's written in articles too. And then there's books Jeff's written that he doesn't want you to read anymore and all of that. But regardless, if you are a hardcore Lakers fan, if you are a hardcore Laker fan, then I would suggest you should definitely check out Showtime and, of course, Winning Time. Now, I mean, I'm Poxy Leonard, and if I can make it through a 500-page book in under 2 weeks, the rest of you should probably breeze right through it.
We'd like to thank our crew here at The Ghost of Hollywood for all their hard work on this episode. We also want to thank Jeff Perlman again for joining us on the show. You can visit his website at jeffperlman.com to keep up with all the latest on his podcast, book tours, and more.
You can also stream Winning Time on Max, so, like, you know, don't hesitate to check it out and catch up on all the latest episodes if you haven't already.
And that's it, Wall Crawlers. We'll return next month with episode 30, featuring director of photography, Pat Capone, discussing his work on the well-known series Succession, and his latest works on Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon.
Ah, you can also check out theghostofhollywood.com for all the latest updates and information on the show. The Ghost of Hollywood also airs. Also, so many alsos here, Reagan. Who wrote this? You write that?
No, I didn't write that.
Man, whatever.
Not the writer of the show.
Anyway, The Ghost of Hollywood also airs late night on KBOO Radio. That's right, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, in Portland, Oregon, and it streams wherever you get your podcast.
Until next time, everybody. Good morning and good night.
Good night. Good night, everybody.
We need to go to bed.
Oh, shut up, Reagan.
You have been listening to another episode of The Ghost of Hollywood. The Ghost of Hollywood is directed by Zach Flannery. The show is authored by Chris Klon and Zach Flannery. Composition samples and score by Jesse Garcia in Pineapple Nightmare. Production management by Mary Flannery at The Electric Garden Company. And mastering by Grady Sizemore in Microphonic Meltdown in Portland, Oregon. For more information on The Ghost of Hollywood, please visit theghostofhollywood.com.